I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Andrew Nagorsky, author of The Nazi Hunters. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Two Jewish Maven on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. A friend of mine asked me last week, does anyone go to services Friday night anymore? It was an innocent question, reflecting the fact that, of course, he doesn't go to services Friday night, but highlighting a cultural change in American Jewry over the last 30 or 40 years. There's a sort of consensus opinion in the American Jewish community these days that Reform and Conservative Jews simply don't go to synagogue on Shabbat anymore. I'm here to tell you that while there is a kernel of truth in that assumption, it's not actually true. In my own congregation, Temple Emmanuel in Tucson, Arizona, last Friday night we had 150 people attend our Shabbat Rock services, 65 people at our late-night downtown Shabbat, and an additional 35 people at our chapel service. Saturday morning there were 150 people in the congregation at a bat mitzvah. Participation in all services was enthusiastic and energetic. But the overall perspective on the "who goes to services anymore?" question is relevant nonetheless. In the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, regular attendance at Friday night services was a pretty standard experience for people who belonged to Reform synagogues in America, while conservative Jews came mostly Saturday morning. While many Jews came much less often, far more people showed up on the High Holy Days, actually everyone showed up on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, there were still lots of people who came to services every week. Those who didn't attend usually felt some embarrassment, at least when they saw their clergy. It was like ordering a BLT and looking up to see the rabbi at the next table. You still ate the sandwich, but you had the decency to look chagrined. In addition to the regulars, many Jews who didn't attend weekly came to services several times a year to observe Yahrzeit, the annual remembrance of a relative who had died. And there were always visitors who came with local relatives or friends who normally attended Shabbat back home but came to shul since they were here. Finally, when there was a bar or bat mitzvah or two, usually there was, or an upcoming wedding or baby naming to celebrate, groups of those guests attended the service too. And monthly synagogues would have some kind of youth-oriented service involving children from the religious school. For Reform temples, this was a monthly, younger, bouncier class service during the school year, set up by the age group, with kids participating in the main service. For conservative shuls, it was junior congregation, a separate service where kids joined the much longer adult service at a particular point. That meant that your normal Shabbat crowd, Friday night for Reform, Saturday morning for Conservative, consisted of regular temple goers, people observing Yahrzeit, visitors, and bar bat mitzvah or wedding guests. Once a month there'd be an influx of younger families and kids. And, of course, on the Jewish High Holy Days, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, everybody showed up. How could you not go to temple on the days of awe? While vestiges of this American Jewish synagogue system remain, things have definitely changed. The generation of post-World War II Jews and their baby boomer children have either passed from the scene or lost the practice of attending services weekly. Newer generations of Jews, younger baby boomers of the Me generation, the forgotten Generation X, and millennials, mostly haven't developed the habit of attending services regularly. Even coming to temple on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is discretionary. More Jews do show up for the High Holy Days than Shabbat, but they definitely don't all come as they used to. Today, special interest groups, if you will, people remembering a loved one, celebrating a bar bat mitzvah, wedding or baby naming, visitors looking for community, somebody related to someone singing in the choir, they are still present, but the regular temple-goer population has simply decreased. In response, Reform synagogues in particular, and a few innovative and conservative and Reconstructionist congregations as well, have introduced a wide variety of musical and service innovations designed to appeal to the large groups of Jews who don't come regularly. Sometimes these attract a particular coterie, the fans of a style of music, poetry, or meditation. Sometimes they work for a while, but require modification, and sometimes they just don't work. They may use interactive technology with large video screens and no prayer books. They may reject technology with services by candlelight. Some services are decidedly informal, others highly presentational. In a culture in which change is constant and the flow of information unending, good synagogues continually work to create and introduce successful new models. Will there be regular Shabbat goers 20 years from now in non-Orthodox congregations? There will. They may not look like the congregants of 1965, 75, or 85. They are already multiracial and include many interfaith couples and some LGBTQ families, and they will definitely like different melodies and styles. But the question, do people still come to Friday night services, will be answered yes. The services are just a little different. To play us in this morning, here's the newly reproduced music from Armon Bizman, the innovative Shabbat service, Sam Golden's composition for Shalom Rav.
Shalom Rav, O Yisrael, Amcha Tasim Leolam. Shalom Rav, O Yisrael, Amcha Tasim Leolam. Shalom Rav, Israel, Amcha Tasim Leolam. Shalom Rav, Israel, Amcha Tasim Leolam. Ki ata
was Shalom Rav from Armon Bizman. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is author Andrew Nagorski, whose new book, The Nazi Hunters, highlights the greatest of the men and women who sought justice for the victims of the Holocaust. Learn what motivated these heroes, which may or may not be what you think, when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Andrew Nagorsky's new book is called The Nazi Hunters. You may have previously read his Hitlerland or many of his other books. It's a fascinating exploration of the people who sought after the Nuremberg trials to find the remaining Nazis. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. Good to talk to you.
Tell us why you decided to write about the Nazi hunters.
For a number of reasons. First of all, as a correspondent for Newsweek in Europe and places like Berlin, Moscow, and Warsaw, of course, the war and the Holocaust, the aftermath, how all of this has played out, were a subject of continuing interest and of continuing news stories. And I got to know people like Simon Wiesenthal and others who kept up the pressure to keep this issue alive. And as I thought about it, I realized also that we're ending this chapter in history. For biological reasons, the last of the Nazi perpetrators are now on trial. They're in their 90s mostly. There will be no Nazis left to prosecute soon. Some of the Nazi hunters are no longer with us. And I felt this was now a time to really assess and tell these stories of these dedicated individuals. And the story has a beginning, middle, and almost an end. And I was struck by just how determined these people were at a time when so many countries, including the United States, the Soviet Union, and the other major powers during the Cold War, simply wanted to forget about what was happening, or at least to downplay it and to move on to other issues.
You know, you begin in a very interesting way in this book by talking about the method of execution used at Nuremberg. Can you explain why that caught your attention?
Well, it caught my attention for two reasons. The defendants of the main trial in Nuremberg were all hanged. So that in itself, the decision of the Allies to hang these people as opposed to executing him by firing squad, which is what the top Nazis like Hermann Göring were asking for, was seen as showing that these were people who were treated as criminals, as not as dignified military figures from the other side, that these people had forfeited any right to a dignified end. And it just so happened that I learned about about someone who had served in the U.S. Army with the hangman who was assigned to this, a master sergeant by the name of John Woods, and who died a long time ago. But this person, Hermann Obermeier, who I talked to, had worked with him at the end of the war, not at Nuremberg itself, but he worked with him on other executions and knew a lot about him. And so he could really tell me a lot about his personality. And one of the real controversial things that happened is that a couple of the hangings appeared to have gone wrong. When someone is hanged, their neck is supposed to snap and death is supposed to be instantaneous. In at least one case, and maybe two, the person who was being hanged in the main case, Julius Streicher, the Hitler's propagandist
from Der Stürmer, of course.
Yeah, Der Stürmer was clearly strangling, and a lot of people thought that the hangman Woods had done this deliberately by setting the knot off center, because Streicher went to the gallows shouting "Heil Hitler," saying that everyone, you know, all the people who hanged him and all Jews be damned, and that this was his revenge. And one of the early themes of the book, The Nazi Hunters, is how what was seen as a quest for revenge at first, at the end of the war, turned into a quest for justice. And this is sort of, to me, this is a kind of a pivotal moment where you see, was revenge still mainly at play, or was this an effort at real justice?
We will continue to discuss Andrew Nagorsky's fascinating book, The Nazi Hunters, with him when we return in just a moment here on Two Jewish. We welcome our friends David and Pamela from Freedom Smoke. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So your product is kosher?
Yes. The base ingredients, the propylene glycol, vegetable glycerin, are both certified kosher, USP grade. It's basically the same product that's put in asthma inhalers.
Where do you get your flavorings from?
Our flavorings come from Flavor Art in Italy. It is definitely the finest flavorings in the world.
And people have a variety of choices.
Yes, they do. We've got over 500 flavors.
Now, the quality of what you provide is very important.
Yes, it is. When people come in, we first find out what kind of cigarettes they've been using, so we know the approximate level of nicotine they'll need. Then we fit them with a flavor that would be perfect for them.
How can people find out more? Where can they go?
They can do one of a couple of things. They can visit us on our website at freedomsmokeusa.com. That's all one word. Or call us on our 800 number, 800-705-7013.
Thanks so much.
Thank a pleasure.
You. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio, or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. We have less than 6 months until we elect a new president of the United States. We continue our 2016 Two Jewish Presidential Report. Casino magnate Sheldon Adelson plans to spend many millions to help elect Donald Trump as president. Trump and Adelson met last week in New York. Adelson was in the city to attend the World Values Network, a Jewish group he helps fund. Adelson, a Jewish billionaire, Republican mega-giver, and pro-Israel philanthropist, said he was ready to spend more than he had in any prior bid to elect a president, in excess of $100 million. Spending by Adelson and his wife Miriam in the 2012 elections was between $100 and $150 million, including money spent on congressional races. Adelson plans to focus almost exclusively on the presidential race this time round. Last week, Adelson declared his support for Trump in a Washington Post op-ed. Until now, Trump has been self-funded, but as he heads into a general election against likely Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton, he will seek outside money. Jewish Republicans have been particularly unsettled by Trump's flip-flops on Israel. Earlier in the primaries, Trump said he would remain neutral on Israel and the Palestinians, refused to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital, and suggested Israel should pay for U.S. defense assistance. Trump has since backed off all those positions, and Sheldon Adelson apparently is now suitably impressed, perhaps to the tune of $100 million. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been exploring the concept of diaspora, the Jewish diaspora, such an important part of Jewish life for so many hundreds and now thousands of years. You started to talk about some of the other diasporas. We explored the Chinese diaspora because it's not just us. Let's look at a couple of others today.
Right. Well, that was one of the oldest and one of the biggest. So we started with them. We'll do a little bit more quickly and not in as much detail. Let's take, for example, the Armenian diaspora. You grew up in L.A., I believe.
I did indeed.
And there is a part of L.A. called Glendale where virtually everybody's Armenian. There are actually more Armenians in greater L.A. than there are in greater Yerevan, which is the capital of modern Armenia.
I should also note that our governor, when I lived there at one point, was George Duke Majin of Armenian descent. Right. Armenians have a very important place in California.
Right. So Armenia is either the oldest or the second oldest Christian nation on earth. It has an autocephalous church. They have their own Vatican and whatever, a very distinctive culture, language, and even alphabet. So in many ways, they're like the Jews. They're an ancient people who, for many centuries, did not have their own land. Their
land, tremendous persecution like the Jews.
Their land was controlled by others, whether it was Russians or Turks or Persians or whatever, often others of different religions, different languages, whatever. They were oppressed. They were driven out from their homes. At one point, Armenia stretched from sea to sea to sea, which means from the Mediterranean to the Black Sea to the Caspian. It was huge at one point in history. There are now Armenians not only in California, but in the south of France and in Belgium and in Lebanon. And Aleppo, as it used to be at least, was half Armenian. Thessaloniki, I mean, all over the Mediterranean world, there are large and important communities of Armenians who, like the Jews, flourished culturally and intellectually in the diaspora. There's also the Irish diaspora, largely an economic diaspora, people fleeing poverty and famine and joblessness, but also English imperialism and persecution. So there's a religious element to that diaspora.
And of course, you know, that Irish population is significant all over the United States, most of whom came because of bad conditions in Ireland.
And not only in the United States, but also all over continental Europe, in Catholic countries in particular, in Rome, in Paris, there's whole Irish neighborhoods and Irish pubs and Irish restaurants and Irish music and Irish dancing. I mean, there's a viable presence. And interestingly, like Jews today, these Irish exiles could return to Ireland now. It's a booming economy. It's one of the fastest growing countries in the European Union, but they choose to remain where they've been already two, three, five generations. It's an interesting case study. We could look at others, but I think we've made the point is that there are diasporas for different reasons historically. They are durable. They're not necessarily portents of the end of identity or the end of nationhood. Certainly the three that we've just mentioned briefly, people carry on very strong identities, whether as Chinese or as Armenians or as Irish, often hyphenated, you know, an Irish American, a Chinese American, or a Chinese Argentinian, whatever. But as we know from our own experience, being in the diaspora doesn't necessarily mean the end of a people. And this is a question we should come back to next week.
We'll come back to it next week. Thanks so much, Tom.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivinan, Israel Oshrad Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrad.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So we had a wonderful experience of Yom HaTzma'ut, a big celebration here. Explain this ceremony that you brought here to Tucson. I'm sure maybe it's elsewhere, but what is the 12 torches? Where does that come from? What's the idea, and how does it work?
So 12 torches is definitely one of the, if not the, important ceremony in Israel. It's the moment that Israel is moving from the saddest day of, you know, of our nation, which we are commemorating the memory of fallen soldiers and victims of terror, to the happiest day, which is Independence Day.
So from Yom HaZikaron to Yom HaTzmaut, from Memorial Day to the Independence Day, the next day.
Yeah, and the ceremony always will start with something sad, like Magasha Kesef, silver platter. Like they will read the same
famous poem
for,
about the silver platter and the young man and the young woman who died, right?
Bidiuk. And they will open with the same poem for 63 years or so, because it wasn't from the beginning of Israel. It took like few years until they came up with this ceremony. And the idea is to really honor 12 people or more, but to light 12 torches, and to which 12 symbolize the 12 tribes of Israel, of course. 12 or remarkable people who really changed Israeli society and sometime the world. Like this year, one of the people who light torch was Rona Ramon, wife of Ilan Ramon, the first Israeli astronaut.
Who died in the explosion of the
Columbia.
Columbia, right. Sorry.
Yeah. And not just for, of course, not just, and she also lost her son. He was pilot as well 8 years ago in
a military crash.
Yeah. So, but not just for her losing, you know, two, you know, beloved ones, but the way she took this loss, and how she's running around Israel in schools and telling people how we need to pull ourselves and always see the bright side of, you know, whatever life.
Incredible to be able to do that with those losses in your life.
Two losses, yeah. And also one of them was a priest who really encouraged the Christian community to go to the army, like doing great job on that. So these kind of people who really changing the society. So every year 12 torches will be lit, and the audience is the prime minister and the president and all the members of Knesset on Mount Herzl. This ceremony on Mount Herzl, a very, very honorable and respectful ceremony. And as you said, we brought it here 3 years ago, and we are very, very happy and proud to emulate this important ceremony and to educate the community about this ceremony in Israel. And every year we choose like 12. This year we choose for 15 people who really made the difference in terms of connecting Tucson and Israel in different ways. And of course, Temple had one candidate, this Libby Quinn.
Right. Who did a great job of connecting our congregation and the religious school
Still
kids
doing.
In a fantastic way. I get just reminded of a quote from Perkei Avot, Ezehu mechubad hamachabed et habriyot, who is honored, it's the one who honors others. And that's a really important principle in celebrating Israel as well. Thanks so much, Ashrat. We'll talk next week.
Rabbi.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
And now it's time for a recurring, inscrutable, irregular feature of Two Jewish Haikus for Jews, the wisdom of Zen Judaism. The Shiva visit. So sorry about your loss. Now, back to my problems. And beyond Valium, peace is knowing one's child is an internist. Those were haikus for Jews, eternal wisdom from Zen Judaism. We welcome our maven on Israel, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Boker Tov, Rabbi. Boker Tov, listeners.
Last week, we started talking about Israel Independence Day. It was just after the fact during our community celebration. Israel has been such a strongly positive aspect of Jewish life in America and all over the world. There are many people who have challenges with Israel today, and it's become very vocal in the media. When those questions filter into school, how do you address them?
Sure. It can be a very complicated situation. It seems that Israel is frequently a punching bag for the public, for right or wrong. And we cannot shy away from the realities that are true today and historically when we're talking about Israel. It's important that our organizations have a baseline that says we support Israel, we value Israel, and that support is unwavering. Having said that, it doesn't mean that we think everything is perfect and that there isn't work to be done. So again, as children are growing, there are certain conversational topics that are appropriate for certain levels of child. Younger kids should know that there are lots of different people that live in Israel. You know, there are Jews, there are Muslims, there are Christians, there are Druze, there are non-religious people, etc. There are all different kinds of races that live in Israel. There are all different kinds of foods that Israelis are producing and eating and industry and things like that. And then as kids are getting older and they're learning more about the complexities of life in modern times, other topics can be introduced. And I think it's important that students are informed of the facts in situations and the realities of situations, and that we try hard to not necessarily present a biased viewpoint and a single-minded viewpoint. With that baseline of support and knowing that we are partners and allies, we love Israel, we support Israel, we can then enter into a contextualized conversation about how complicated it is for example, to have a democracy in a place like Israel, which is a very tiny nation surrounded by other countries that have historically been hostile.
And aren't democracies.
And are not democracies. And so, you know, as Americans, we get a lot of ideas in our minds about what freedom should look like and what equality should look like. And we lose sometimes the perspective of what it's like around the globe. You know, what does it mean to be equal in South America or in Africa or places in Asia? You know, freedom and equality are seen differently and viewed differently in all kinds of cultures. So it's important that I think as we dialogue about Israel, we also have a broad picture and a broad view in mind.
Thanks, John. We will talk next week.
You're welcome.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Morris turned 60 years old. He went to the doctor for a physical. The doctor said, "Morris, you're in very good shape. I can't find anything wrong with you. You'll probably live to be 100. How old was your father when he died?" And Morris replied, "Did I say he was dead? He's 83 years old. He goes jogging and Israeli dancing every week." The doctor was surprised. "So how old was your grandfather when he died?" Morris again answers, "Did I say he was dead, doctor?" Doctor's astonished. "You mean to tell me that you're 60 and your father and grandfather are both still alive? Is your grandfather active?" And Morris replied, "He goes swimming twice a week, plays a full round of golf every Sunday. He is 107 years old, and next month he's getting married again." The doctor asked, "If he's 107, why on earth would your grandfather want to get married?" Morris looked him in the eye and said, "Did I say he wanted to?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well for a long time. And now a word of Torah. This week we complete the book of Leviticus with the portion of Bechukotai. At the completion of a book that focused on holiness and its rituals of sanctification and celebration, we conclude our exploration with a statement of covenant. God says, "If you keep these, my laws of holiness, you will long flourish in the land that I'll give you." It is a promise based on action. If we live lives dedicated to holiness, our actions bring blessing. We have the capacity to create a world that has meaning and goodness. Holiness is a strange idea. In Judaism, it's usually something we create rather than something given to us from above or outside. An example, a sheepskin is not a holy object. You can make a coat out of it or use it to cover car seats, especially if you have a convertible. Nothing holy about that. So what happens if you take a sheepskin, remove the hair, and cure it into parchment? Is it holy now? No, it's just a piece of leather paper. But if you take that parchment, give it to a sofer, a scribe, who writes on it a section of the text of Torah, and that piece of parchment is sewn together with other pieces, and the whole parchment roll is wrapped around wooden poles, dedicated, carried around a synagogue, and chanted from publicly. Blessings are said. It's used for bar and bat mitzvahs, touched and kissed with the fringes of a tallis. Well, now, that piece of parchment has become something much more. It has become a Torah, and holy. But it has become holy through our own actions. We have taken a common object, a sheepskin we could have used for any number of things, and created out of it an object that is sacred, holy. The abiding lesson of Leviticus is that we have the capacity to make our own lives sacred in a similar way. We can lead lives that are ordinary and prosaic, or we can choose to live truly holy lives. We make that choice every day, sometimes hourly, when we decide how we're going to act. When we give freely of ourselves, as Leviticus asks, we increase holiness in the world, and we give our lives beauty, meaning, and sanctity. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, best-selling author Andrew Nagorski, will tell us about the very last of the Nazi hunters and what their legacy is when we return on To Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi made an unusual appeal last week to both Israelis and Palestinians, asking them to take historic steps for peace, just as his country did in 1979. If by our combined efforts and real desire we can all achieve a solution to this problem and find hope for the Palestinians and security for the Israelis, history will write a new page that will be no less and might even be more of an achievement than the signing of the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel 40 years ago, Sisi said. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu responded immediately that he's open to working with Egypt and other Arab nations to advance a diplomatic process ending the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Israel is ready to participate with Egypt and other Arab states in advancing both the diplomatic process and stability in the region. I appreciate President Sisi's work and also draw encouragement from his leadership on this important issue, Netanyahu added. Sisi's remarks come amid a push by France to jumpstart the peace process, which has been frozen since April 2014. France agreed to delay the May 30th launch of its new Israeli-Palestinian peace initiative until sometime this summer in order to allow U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry to attend. In other Middle East news, the Lebanese terror group Hezbollah asked Western journalists not to report that Israel was behind the assassination of Mustafa Badreddin, Hezbollah's military chief. Georges Malbruno, Middle East reporter for the French daily newspaper Le Figaro, wrote about the assassination of Hezbollah's top commander. Hezbollah asked the journalists who asked for its reaction to Badreddin's liquidation to avoid saying Israel is involved in the attack, Malbruno wrote. According to Malbruno, a diplomat told him that it could be of little doubt that the assassination of Badreddin is the continuation of the Israeli liquidations of Hezbollah's senior leaders. Hezbollah emphasized Badreddin was killed near Damascus Airport by an artillery shell fired by a Syrian rebel group. Although Hezbollah did not publicly accuse Israel of his assassination, during the burial ceremony of Badreddin, leaders in the terror organization voiced anti-Israel statements, naming Syrian heretic rebel groups as the spearhead of the American Zionist project in the Middle East. And in Ann Arbor, Michigan, a Jewish couple from Detroit is pressing a Michigan public radio station to broadcast a birthday greeting to Israel paid for by their sponsorship. Hanan and Lisa Liss made a donation to Michigan Radio, a public radio group operated by the University of Michigan, that entitled them to sponsor a day's broadcast and have a message read on the air 6 times. The couple requested that Happy 68th Birthday Israel be broadcast on Israel Independence Day, Yom Ha'atzmaut, May 12th. Hanan Liss is an Israeli citizen and has a son serving in the Israeli army. Lisa Liss is a daughter of Weight Watchers CEO Florine Marks. The station rejected the message, saying in a letter to the couple, "We have determined that this message would compromise the station's commitment to impartiality, that it crosses over into advocacy or could imply advocacy." There's so much anti-Israel sentiment and rhetoric and lies out there. I just wanted something positive about Israel to be announced on the radio, Lisa Liss said. When they offered a day's sponsorship to me, I genuinely publicly wanted to wish Israel happy birthday from my husband and myself. I don't see how happy birthday is political. Apparently, when it involves Israel, it becomes so, which is ludicrous. Shame on Michigan Public Radio. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Andrew Nagorsky. His new book is called The Nazi Hunters. He served as Newsweek's bureau chief in Hong Kong, Moscow, Rome, Bonn, Warsaw, and Berlin. You may remember his book Hitlerland and several of his other books that have explored a variety of themes. Hannah Arendt is a very interesting character, the Jewish philosopher. She wrote Eichmann, and the whole analysis of Eichmann in Jerusalem was very controversial when she wrote it. And her own history was a little complicated, having been Martin Heidegger's mistress. Can you explore her character and what you found out about her in researching the book?
Well, Hannah Arendt, as you say, was highly controversial. She went to, well, she grew up in Germany, then fled Germany. She considered herself a fairly secular Jew, but was clearly prosecuted for being, felt she had to flee because she was Jewish, which of course was the case of many German Jews. And she was a powerful intellectual. Her book, The Origins of Totalitarianism, is a classic in the field. She really believed in overarching theories. And so when Adolf Eichmann was kidnapped by the Mossad in Buenos Aires, and this remarkable operation that I describe in detail in the book, and brought back to stand trial in Israel, there was a lot of controversy within the Jewish community, particularly about whether this was the right move. Many prominent Jews advised Israel not to do this, interestingly enough, feeling that Israel should not get in the business of trying a figure like Eichmann. And Arendt was of that mindset initially too, and so she went over and wrote a series for the five-part series for the New Yorker that became her book Eichmann in Jerusalem, which was extremely critical of a lot of the things that happened in the courtroom. But first of all, she propagated the theory that Eichmann was kind of a little man, a cog in the machine, rather than someone who was a conscious who was motivated by bloodlust, as it were. And this fit into her theory of totalitarianism and
kind
how,
of the whole notion of Eichmann as a faceless bureaucrat, or nearly mindless, numb bureaucrat.
Yes, and she even used the expression, he almost appeared to be comic, not in ha-ha comic, but it's sort of like this, someone you wouldn't take seriously. Of course, we've had a lot of information about Eichmann since then, which shows that that was the way he was trying to present himself, but that's hardly an accurate description. But I think her point, and I get into this whole debate about her interpretation of the trial and of Eichmann's role, is that that view, as opposed to Eichmann is a monster, which she really opposed, because she felt if you call somebody a monster, in some ways you sort of detach him from the human experience and say, oh, that was done by those Nazi monsters, not by humans, and therefore, it's the everybody else really wasn't that significant. So I think there are parts of her thesis and parts of her opponent's thesis that over time you can see are not mutually contradictory. But she was also a very arrogant intellectual. There's no question about it. She did not make friends easily, and she made a lot of enemies through the way she constructed her picture of Eichmann.
The Nuremberg trials, some people thought of them as an attempt to take vengeance, the war crimes trial. You make a really important point that it was about justice. For many of these people that led the Nuremberg trials were not Jewish. I had a chance to see Justice Jackson late in his life when I was living in South Carolina.
Oh, that's fabulous.
A remarkable man, actually.
I envy you that.
It was very special. Talk a little bit about the motivation behind the original Nuremberg trials, and then we'll go deeper into the Nazi hunting experience.
Right. I mean, I think many Germans initially believed this was Victor's justice, as they call it. But Victor's justice would have been to do what was always done in previous wars. The victors would have just executed a bunch of the vanquished at their leisure without any attempt at a court proceeding, a trial of actually spelling out what they were being executed for. And there was, of course, a huge push for vengeance, a fury. The Red Army was furious as it marched through Eastern Europe to Germany and was famous for brutalizing and killing and raping. But even American soldiers, for instance, who liberated Dachau, when they saw the piles of bodies, the emaciated survivors, the signs of torture, were not inclined to help much the remaining SS guards, some of whom were being rounded up and killed by the survivors. So part of the idea of the Nuremberg trials is you've got to create some order in this system and actually stop this vengeance, which is something a lot of people didn't realize. And the other part is it is essential to have trials such as this to show the world what really happened. We tend to forget there was still in 1945, 46, 47, a huge level of denial among Germans, Austrians, and others about what had happened. And this great myth that we were simply fighting the war the way everybody fought a war. Bad things happened, but that's always true. And to simply confront people with witnesses, with documents, with footage from the liberation of the camps, that would put this in the historical record and set a whole new standard about what is acceptable behavior and what is not acceptable behavior. Even then, there were international norms, like you did not target civilians deliberately, which, of course, the Nazi regime did at every turn, and not just Jews, others as well. But there was still this effort to show, unless you set the historical record straight, and by the way, punish the at least some of the most egregious executioners, you will never be able to have a set of rules or understood rules for the future.
Let's talk about some of the most famous Nazi hunters. You devote a good deal of the book to Simon Wiesenthal, the most famous of them. I want to talk briefly about Beata Klarsfeld. Maybe also because I had the opportunity to hear her and speak to her when she spoke in my congregation many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Nazi hunters aren't always easy people to hang out with.
Oh, no. And one of the assumptions a lot of people have is if you're writing a book about Nazi hunters, the story will be sort of good guys versus bad guys, to put it crudely. And, of course, there's that. But these people, this relatively small group of people who made it their life's mission to bring Nazis to justice, were normal people. Wiesenthal, Beate Klarsfeld, Serge Klarsfeld, Eli Rosenbaum from the Justice Department in Washington. They too have their own ambitions. There was a lot of feuding between them over tactics and over who should be praised for what, and who handled something badly. And so you have a lot of that. And Beate Klarsfeld, and for those of your listeners who don't know much about her, is this first of all, she did not grow up Jewish. She was in a German family. Her father was in the Wehrmacht, in the German army. It was a typical situation in Berlin where, as she was growing up, she was born in 1939, and as she was growing up, her parents did not talk about the war. They certainly didn't talk about the Holocaust and other atrocities. And then at age 20, she goes to Paris as an au pair. She meets this man, Serge Klarsfeld, whose father had died in Auschwitz. She begins to really, for the first time in her life, understand what was done in the name of Germany during World War II, and she's horrified. And she becomes this radical, confrontational Nazi hunter who actually, for instance, in 1968, when there is a German chancellor briefly by the name of Kurt Georg Kiesinger, who had served the Nazi regime, she is so outraged by this, she gets a press pass, slips in during a party convention, up to the podium, manages to get close to him and slaps him and shouts at him. Of course, she's arrested, but it could have been much worse. This was 1968, the year when Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy were assassinated. There were massive student demonstrations and riots. But those were the kinds of dramatic gestures she and her husband felt they had to make to bring attention to these kinds of issues, which, for instance, was a huge point of dispute between her and Simon Wiesenthal, who did not like this kind of confrontational tactics. He was, I gather evidence, I try put on pressure, but I don't sort of do drama. And Beate Klarsfeld did drama very effectively, as did her husband. He was sort of often seen as the more low-key guy, but he too could sometimes take very dramatic actions.
I want to thank Andrew Nagorski. Great interview and a wonderful book, The Nazi Hunters. So much more to talk about, the supposed secret Jewish death squads and lots more in the book. You can find it on Amazon. Is there a good website to go to find out more about the Nazi hunters?
Well, you can find it obviously on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, anywhere else. But I have my personal website where it's andrewnagorski.com, written together. And there I have all those links, the stories, some of the articles I've done, interviews, and so forth.
Andrew, thanks so much. Best of luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish. May Rabbi Sam Kohan join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Rabbi Mark Borovitz of Beit Shuvah, author of Finding Recovery in Yourself in Torah, A Daily Spiritual Path to Wellness. Our playout this morning comes from Armon Bizman as well. It's their Vishamru, the Covenant of Shabbat. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
of Shabbat, the Torah Taberit Olam. Visham Reuven Israel, Et HaShabbat, Et HaShabbat, Tasson, Et HaShabbat, the Torah Taberit Olam.